Colonel John Graves Simcoe delivered the first Valentine card in North America. A century later, another colonel, James Sutherland Buster Brown, Simcoe born and bred, drafted Defense Scheme No. 1, the Canadian government's secret 1921 plan to invade key U.S. cities in the event of war. That about covers the claim to fame of Simcoe, Ontario. I was born there when it was a town of 6,000. Now it's more than doubled, a bedroom community for Hamilton and Toronto. Simcoe prospered with a rich agricultural base, and tobacco was the big industry when I was a boy. No Ontario town was ever nominated to be sister city to Florence, and there were good reasons why Simcoe was among the non-starters. Scottish conservatism is as close to the opposite of Florentine culture as can be imagined. Piano lessons and church choirs sufficed as culture, which otherwise had no role in the life of the town. Kids like me avoided Sunday school and regular church attendance. We were unwitting cultural morons who couldn't miss what we never had. As did all heathens, we wallowed in an idyllic freedom. This got a huge boost from the Second World War, which removed innumerable dads and further loosened the controls on our behavior. Domestic life and disciplining kids became, by default, the duty of wives, and wives of that era seldom ruled households harshly. The McCall family was big, 5 boys and, eventually, 1 girl. Mike, Hugh, me, twins Tom and Walter, and Chris. I attribute my lifelong shunning of group activities to this. My antipathy took a brief time out when I was suckered into Lord Baden-Powell's Boy Scouts as a cub at the bottom of a hierarchy of ranks not unlike the arrangements in the Vatican. Boy Scouts patiently climbed up in modest increments. At the summit stood the Sea Scouts, as elite as the King's Mounted Household Guards. I never saw a Sea Scout. I still suspect they were a gaudy invention, like Jesus, to keep all Boy Scouts striving. I salivated when I landed on the Sea Scouts section of the official Scouts catalog. What greedy kid wouldn't want that inventory? There were silken neckerchiefs, an over-the-shoulder leather Sam Brown belt, a steel canteen, a second belt around the waist, its clasp ingeniously mating 2 halves to form the Boy Scout's escutcheon, a small leather case clipped to the belt for fishing lures, small change, the odd whistle or rubber band, a hornpipe dangling from the same belt. Over the left shoulder, a set of semaphore signaling flags in a cylindrical leather case. There were pockets and flaps on the official Sea Scout shirt, binoculars on a strap slung around the neck, knee socks, a pair of waterproof Sea Scout brogans, sewn onto the shirt front and sleeves, resembling a horde of caterpillars, were cloth Sea Scout badges of merit. Bed making, swimming, diving, drowning cat rescue, tree felling, completion of an anti-seasickness course. Badges commemorating a fire extinguished, a torpedo assembled, a torpedo disassembled. And in the Sea Scout model's hand, a silver whistle so powerful that when blown in Cairo, it could be heard in Johannesburg. Only the sons of mining company CEOs, arms dealers, and senior officers of secret banks could afford the complete Sea Scout uniform. I grieved for my fundlessness, my bilious green, beanie-like, peaked cap cut to the pattern of every English public school boy's cap since Tom Brown's school days, was my only item of Cubs regalia.